Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a labor shortage, especially in West Michigan. Construction jobs going unfilled. On today's program, what it means for the housing industry and the state economy as a whole. And then after this weekend's heartbreaking loss to the Boston Red Sox, Tigers manager Jim Leland announced he is retiring. We find out more about this man who led the Tigers to the last three AL Central titles later in the program. But first, this fall, Bridge Magazine is taking a close look at the challenges Michigan faces as we try to improve our education system. The starting point for all of this is where Michigan students stand as compared to students across America, and then how students in the U.S. compare to other nations. American students rank 17th in reading, 23rd in science, and 31st in math. That puts us behind students in countries such as Poland and Slovenia. As for Michigan, we're somewhere in the middle of the American pack. Education Week ranked Michigan's K-12 education 24th. So all of this begs the question, how well are students in Michigan prepared for the good education that's needed to enter the middle class? Bridge Magazine senior writer Ron French is seeking the answer in his series of special reports for Bridge Magazine. Ron French, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Cynthia.
Seems real clear that you feel that new teachers in our state are really going into their careers unprepared.
Absolutely. And I should say right off the bat that Michigan is not out of the norm. This is probably more normal than being better prepared across the United States.
Because when you look at the American student scores compared to the rest of the world.
Right. And we're not saying that Michigan's teacher training is notably worse than other states, but do we want it to be notably better? We came in with the perspective that teachers are incredibly important to every family. And does our system of teacher training really reflect the importance of that job?
So you begin by outlining what you see are three major problems. The first being colleges and universities. Do you believe they are letting academically weak students into education programs?
Yes.
To what extent?
There are schools in the state that accept students into teacher training programs with ACT scores as low as 15. I find that unacceptable, that the average ACT score in the state is about 21, and every person in the state takes it as a junior.
Mm-hmm.
So these are students who scored well below the average. I think the percentile ranking for 15 is about the 18th percentile. So these are students who are in the 18th percentile in their high school classes, and they're being accepted into teacher training programs. Now, once they get into them, they obviously have to take the courses just like everybody else.
Sure.
But in countries like Finland that have such fantastic education programs, they only accept students that are in the top 5 to 10% of their classes. And we're accepting people in the top 70 to 80% in some programs.
And at the same time, your report finds Michigan's turning out three times more teachers than we have slots for in the state. So we're churning out an overlarge number, it seems. So we could stand to see some winnowing.
No one would have a shortage of teachers if we raise the standards in both ACTs and for certification of students once they graduate from college.
Why would a school let someone so academically weak into a course of study where they will be teaching others?
Teaching in America has always been an easy in, easy out type of profession. It dates back to the 1800s, and no one has ever changed the system. It's considered something where traditionally women have been teachers, and women often in the past would quit when they got married or had children. Obviously, that's different today. Mm-hmm. But the system has not changed since then. And so the idea is it's sort of an assembly line type of mindset where they're viewed as replaceable parts. There's almost a sense that all these teachers can be replaced with the next generation. And frankly, from a school point of view, new teachers are cheaper. From a university's point of view, it doesn't hurt to have more people enrolled. There are a lot of incentives to keep the system the way it is. The only one who's losing really are students who often are in classrooms with teachers who don't have as much training as they probably should.
I'm speaking with Bridge Magazine senior writer Ron French, whose series of special reports for Bridge Magazine is looking at the state of teacher preparedness in Michigan. Ron, you expressed some real concern in your reporting with the state certification tests. You don't think that these tests are weeding out the poorly prepared teacher candidates. Talk to us more about what you found.
Well, there are two places that you can set the bar higher. One is entry into teacher training programs, and the other is at the opposite end when they graduate from college and looking at the tests they take. For example, attorneys, a little over half of attorneys pass the bar exam on the first try. Teachers, 80% pass on the first try, 88% try pass eventually. Because you're allowed to take the test over and over again until you pass them.
I know you quoted one teacher who's in the second year of her teaching career, and she says, the elementary certification test is a joke. So what is keeping us from toughening these certification standards all along the line?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure what. Illinois did toughen their standards, and their pass rate dropped from about 88% down to about 50%. And they still have plenty of teachers for their slots.
Although you did note in your report that it weeded out a lot of minority candidates.
That was a ripple effect of that. And that's something that Michigan would have to address if they did the same thing. But we could do it. We could do it. There just hasn't been a political will to do it.
And what did you hear as you talked with the people who run colleges of education at schools? I know you spoke with Dean Deborah Ball at the University of Michigan. You spoke with education deans at Michigan State University. What do they say? They're the ones turning out teachers.
University programs feel, as you would expect, that they're doing a good job. And I must say that we have some of the best teacher training programs in the nation. Michigan State and the University of Michigan are both ranked very, very highly. It's just we also have a total of 33 or 34 teacher training programs in the state.
And they're not all created equal.
No. And the teachers that come out of them are not all created equal. So what you get is universities defending their own programs, which is understandable. Some of them are very good. Mm-hmm. And I think what you sense from them is a sense of frustration on their part that there are so many programs out there, and why aren't we closing down some programs that are producing teachers who may not be as qualified as those coming out of Michigan, Michigan State, and some of the other larger programs.
Speaking of frustration, a third part of the problem you identified is you're finding too many teachers are quitting within 5 years just out of frustration. Is there a sense of how many is too many? What kind of attrition rate is there?
In teaching, about 40% of new teachers quit within 5 years. So that means that 2 out of 5 teachers spend as much time or more time training to be a teacher as they actually do teaching. In Michigan, 1 out of 6 students are in a classroom at least for part of the day where they are taught by a teacher with 1 year or less experience. And why is that a problem? Because just like your profession or my profession, anyone's profession, mm-hmm. you know, you're not as good the first day you walk in as you are 10 years in. And so when you have that many teachers with 1 year experience and many of them quitting before they become basically journeyman teachers at about 4 or 5 years when studies say they are fully competent, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. then you are putting a lot of our students in classrooms where they are not going to learn as much as they would otherwise.
And you found in your reporting that these inexperienced raw teachers tend to wind up where?
It was pretty surprising. We found that most of those inexperienced teachers are ending up at high poverty urban schools. Just shockingly high numbers there compared to suburban schools. And so the problem that creates obviously is that the students who are most in need of good teaching are the students who are least likely to get it.
Let's take it from a teacher's perspective. Is it any surprise that, you know, with state aid education being cut, you have teachers dipping into their pockets to buy basic supplies, especially in these more impoverished districts? You have larger classes, flat paychecks. Who wouldn't want to flee to a district providing a better living or get out of the field altogether?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There are many incentives. But if we as a state are going to address this, and in many nations that are high academic performing nations, they provide incentives for the best teachers to work in the highest poverty schools. And so could we as a state decide that we are going to incentivize teachers in some way, that teachers that are classified as master teachers are given financial incentives in some way to work in a Detroit or a Pontiac or a Flint.
So this really seems like the underlying issue is not the teachers per se, but the value our state puts on education.
This is not a teacher problem at all. This is a system problem. You only are as good as the tools you have to work with. And many of these teachers do not have the tools that they should have.
And as you point out, there's a study you cited in your piece that finds teachers account for about 20% of student achievement and other in-school influences account for another 10%. So there's that whopping 70% of out-of-school influences. What do we want to say as a state, or what can we do about family attitudes, parental involvement? Where does that even begin when you look at that 70%? You have teachers saying, how can we fight that if you have parents who can't even be bothered to come to conferences or sign a report card?
Absolutely. And that is something that the legislature is struggling with right now when they're looking at teacher evaluations, because whether we like it or not, in another year or two, teachers are going to be evaluated partly on the scores of their students. And there's a lot of anxiety out there about mm-hmm. how that is going to be measured and how you're going to judge a teacher in a high poverty district compared to a teacher who is in Bloomfield Hills.
Well, we have put links to Ron French's series of reports on Michigan's teacher preparation on our website at michiganradio.org. I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest. Ron, always good talking with you. Ron French, senior writer for Bridge Magazine. Thanks for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
Up next, George and Ira Gershwin made their mark on American musical history. Now a new initiative at the University of Michigan is aimed at bringing their music to students and performers and audiences around the world. And then longtime Detroit Tigers manager Jim Leland announced today he is stepping down from the job. That story in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That's George Gershwin himself at the piano playing his 1924 composition, Rhapsody in Blue. As important as George Gershwin and his brother Ira are to the history of American music, there has never been a definitive critical edition of their joint body of work. But that is about to change. The entire music world sat up and took great notice of the announcement that the Gershwin family and the University of Michigan have formed a partnership. It's called the Gershwin Initiative, and it's ultimately going to bring Gershwin's music to students and audiences all around the world. Joining me now in the studio is Mark Clegg, who's an associate professor of musicology at the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and he will be the editor-in-chief of the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Oh, thrilled to be here, Cindy.
Well, the idea that you and your team are going to be able to plunge headfirst into Gershwin scores and drafts and letters and with the blessing of the Gershwin family, that must be professionally and personally thrilling for you.
You know, I have to say it's one of the best days of my life when the phone rings and on the other end of the line is Todd Gershwin, who's the great nephew of George and Ira and turns out to have been a graduate of the University of Michigan from 1993, and he was just calling to see if we'd be interested in doing a critical edition. He had no idea really about the tradition of American studies here at the university and that we were one of the few places in the world really that could take on this work. So it's just an amazing treat for me and a huge privilege to be able to touch these materials and, you know, hold the pieces of paper that George and Ira wrote on and it sort of marked their creative legacy. It's a thrill.
And Todd, what sports management major? So he wasn't even part of your world of performing arts, was
Yeah, he's
he?
Not a graduate of the music school, exactly. But I think he, you know, one. I think there is a key there to his training at Michigan, which is that he looks at the Gershwin legacy as something that needs to be proactively developed and shaped and curated, right? So it's really the first time the family has ever really thought about, you know, not just sitting waiting for the phone to call for other people to come up with projects, but for them themselves to inspire work on George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin's work.
What led to that? What led to that family, to the Gershwin family's understanding that more needed to be done and there needed to be a critical edition?
I've, you know, really gotten to know Mark Gershwin, who's Todd's father and George and Ira's nephew. And he tells me actually about a great moment with one of our board members, Andrew Litton, who's now the music director of the Colorado Symphony and has been a longtime performer of George and Ira's work. And he actually was like the neighbor of Mark when they were growing up. So it's a long family connection. And Andrew's a pianist himself. But anyway, so Andrew was conducting a version of Porgy and Bess. And so Mike Strensky, who's the nephew of Leonor Gershwin, who's Ira's wife.
Okay, so he's the Ira side.
Exactly. And Mark, we're there. They actually go to almost every performance of Gershwin all around the world. I mean, they're very involved and incredibly knowledgeable, really, about, you know, their uncle's work. It's pretty impressive. But anyway, they came back to talk to Andrew after the performance, and Andrew said, you know, these parts are a disaster. The score has so many mistakes in it. I can barely read it. You know, we're having to work too hard just to get the notes out and not really to be able to focus on the artistry of, you know, George and Ira's
work,
you know. And so to be able to have clean parts for really the first time, I mean, it's sort of mesmerizing to me that this work even needs to be done. You'd think someone as famous as George Gershwin, as Ira Gershwin, who've had the kind of impact that they've had on American culture, you know, they're these keen observers of American life, of this sort of transformative time in the roaring 20s when there's all this excitement. But it's a real pivotal moment for us as a country. And to have this be neglected for all these years, to fall between the cracks, is just – it's amazing to me. I mean, it's exciting to me because my work wouldn't be necessary if it weren't for this sort of historical quirk. But it's true. The George Gershwin legacy, the Ira Gershwin legacy, as far as the quality of the, you know, curation and care that's been given to these parts is really sort of a disaster. I mean, in terms of the, you know, just what's on the page, what's legible. And it's because the whole history of his music publishing has been fragmented under many different the whole history has been fragmented among many different companies. And because George died tragically at the age of 38 from a sudden brain tumor, you know, and it shocked Ira. Ira stopped writing lyrics at all for 4 years after George died. I mean, it just completely disrupted the family to have him disappear so suddenly. And so, you know, unlike someone like Aaron Copland, who lived to be
very
90
ripe old
years
age,
old,
yes.
And who, you know, worked with professional classical music publishers who really, you know, valued the precise instructions of the score. You know, George comes from a popular music background from Tin Pan Alley, where you give a kind of recipe, you know, sort of like cooking. You say, you want a little bit of this ingredient, a little bit of that ingredient, you mix them together and you create this wonderful, you know, aromatic musical journey. But it's more of a kind of guide than a precise set of instructions. And so what we're going to do is sort of bring those kind of values of academic publishing, of really trying to get to the very bedrock of what George and Ira were trying to do with their work, and represent that on the page. And that's sort of what a critical edition is. A critical edition makes its editing choices clear on the page so that the user, the reader, the musician, the public knows exactly what they have, as opposed to sort of doing all this silently in the background and you can't tell what's the editor and what's the author.
Okay.
Right? So we're going to be real clear about that. And I think musicians are going to find it inspiring because they're going to understand George and Ira's creativity more deeply, and audiences are going to hear a kind of fresh take. They're going to hear that excitement of ensembles being able to focus for the first time on what the, you know, what they can bring to life about this music, as opposed to just what the music is.
It's Mark Clegg I'm speaking with. Mark is the Associate Professor of Musicology at the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and he gets to be the Editor-in-Chief of the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition, a new partnership that has just recently been announced between the Gershwin family and the University of Michigan, basically bringing a critical edition of their works to the world. Now, let's take a listen right now. This is George Gershwin as he sits at a piano to play An American in Paris. This was in 1927. And now, the orchestral version of the same piece. So, Mark, tell us more about what has been missing. Help us understand what conductors and musicians have not had that your project is going to give them as you go forward, so to help them interpret and perform Gershwin.
That's a great question. So Laura Schissel, who's one of our editorial board members, and he's on the staff of the Library of Congress, is also a conductor. And he spends a lot of time when he works with ensembles sort of changing the parts, getting the musicians to write in individually the correct notes to be able to take out some of the kind of swing era misunderstandings of what George Gershwin's music is. You know, it's a little bit tricky. In some ways, George's musical roots are more in the ragtime era. They're more in that sort of initial blush of jazz in the 19-teens, as opposed to what a lot of us remember now in the 1940s, which is when Gershwin's music was really sustained and kept alive by jazz musicians, right? So during a time when classical musicians and symphony orchestras saw George Gershwin's music as kind of fluff, as pop music, mm-hmm. right, and didn't really rank the same as Beethoven or Mozart.
Perhaps the way audiences today might say, oh, John Williams, they're doing the suite from Star Wars. Oh, how nice.
Which is really unfair because this music that taps into popular culture is sort of, it speaks to us. It's who we are. It's our symphony of the age, you know. So, and George was able to do that. But during the 40s, it was really jazz musicians who made all of these tunes like I Got Rhythm into what we call jazz standards. And they did incredible numbers of variations and treated again as this kind of clay that they could shape into new works, new
that's
compositions.
Jazz.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so but our sort of oral memory of what Gershwin sounds like is a little different than what George would have played had he been living in the 40s and been part of that jazz. If we had him on record, it would sound really lean. It would sound very sort of angular, very fast. And you can hear that in the Rhapsody in Blue that opened the program. Mm-hmm. I mean, how quick it is compared to maybe the kind of more languorous romantic versions we might know today. So,
and this is a good thing for the public to be able to understand, people who maybe just think of that as something that's in the back of an airline ad.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's get some appreciation for the body of work.
Right. I hear the kind of the roaring 20s, the energy and the kind of the just rapid pace of life in the 1920s of change in George's music in a way that I think we'll be able to refresh and make that clear in our editions.
The idea that this project is likely to take 40 or so years is absolutely stunning. How much material is there for you to have to plow through and work on?
It almost scares me to hear you say that, but it's my dean Christopher Kendall was the first one who pointed that out, that we're really looking at four decades of work, and it's because George and Ira were so prolific. I mean, when you include the musicals, the Broadway stage works, I mean, you're talking about several dozen. 2-hour works, with incredible musical numbers and also things that they're tricky to represent on paper because, again, they're more kind of recipes than they are, sets of instructions. So there are works that could be moved or changed or cut, slid around, and we have to show all those possibilities to really inspire today's artists, today's directors, today's singers to treat this as something they can bring their own creativity to and really bring alive on the stage. And then there's all the film music. I mean, one of the things that happened during the Great Depression is the creation of sound film technology. And so a lot of great composers and songsmiths went from New York to Hollywood and started cranking out amazing film scores. So Shall We Dance and, Delicious and all these wonderful movies that use George's music. We're going to be able to represent those as well. And so, I mean, it's actually a great thing that George was I don't know if he was a savvy businessman, but he retained a lot of the rights. The family has held these rights. And so having their blessing and their encouragement in this is huge and is key to sort of bringing all of these commercial interests in line behind what is really a nonprofit project. I mean, nobody's going to make a lot of money off of this. The university is investing a lot, in just because they know this work is so important. The Gershwins really were observers of modern life, and they broke down boundaries between different genres. So where we would see the blues and jazz and Broadway and the classical concert hall as being all separate, as having their own rules and their own musical. They just ignored them. It just wasn't part of their worldview that these things couldn't be mixed together. And so I think of them as kind of prophets of American culture because they were the ones who really saw how diversity and bringing ideas together and, bringing African-American jazz and the energy from Harlem into Carnegie Hall – was what the magic of what American cultural life was all about. You know, and so the Rhapsody in Blue, I mean, the power and excitement that it communicates. I mean, it's two reasons. One is that it's bringing these kind of new spices of culture together for the first time in this fantastic combination. But it's also because it's just great melodies and great music making. And, you know, George's own sort of spontaneity and creativity, how fast he worked, really comes – you can feel that excitement in the musical discourse.
Do you remember your first listening to a Gershwin piece that really hit home to you?
You know, I think that my real love is an American in Paris. And actually, I'm going to be the editor of American Paris. Since I'm in charge, I get to decide what I do. So I chose that one. And it's partially because I'm a bassoonist. And, you know, so I measure great music by how good the bassoon solo is. Now, Gershwin, I love even though there are no huge bassoon solos. It's not the Rite of Spring. But there's this really, between sort of the first and second parts of the American in Paris, there's just two notes. It's just dum. And, you know, I just, for some reason, that to me, I always just play it as a musician in this way that sort of blurs the two notes, almost like that opening glissando in Rhapsody in Blue, but just, it's just an E to an F. And, you know, I think as a player, when I fell in love with an American in Paris, because to me, it's like Beethoven. I mean, it's really tightly constructed. It's a tone poem. It tells a story just like, you know, maybe Beethoven 6, the pastoral does. But it's just beautifully put together. The orchestration is fantastic. The colors, the life, the energy of that piece. For me, I just fell in love with that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm in love with Gershwin.
So when does the work begin, or has it begun?
You know, it's already begun. The Gershwin family actually commissioned a scholar named Wayne Shirley, who's on our board, to begin working on the Porgy and Bess edition, you know, back when Andrew Litton complained about the quality of the parts. And so that actually is completely drafted. Now, that's an enormous work. There's like over 3 hours of music. It's almost never performed in its entirety because it's just too long. It certainly wasn't premiered that way because you couldn't do a three-hour work on Broadway.
Yes.
So that'll be... We're already at work on that. We're already at work on Rhapsody in Blue. We're already at work on some of the early Gershwin compositions, a string quartet, which he did as a student. You know, I think it's going to be really exciting just to watch all these things come out. But that said, we've got to work out details with the publisher about all the nitty-gritty details of like how big is that font and you know, how much does that italics tilt and those kind of really picky details. So it'll be a couple years before we start seeing things come out. But I'm excited about that because as these editions get done, we're going to wrap this into a broader educational initiative at the university. So for us, it's really a two-part project. So there's this exciting edition project, which as a musicologist, that's what I do. But I also teach, right? And a lot of my colleagues teach. And so the opportunity to perform these works on stage, you know, to have our students really embrace this music and to approach it, these scores, with the kind of understanding that we're going to develop in courses and seminars and with workshops and visiting speakers and visiting directors from Broadway, you know, to bring these alive with our students, both in history classes and in performance, I think it's just a huge opportunity to address some of these issues of American culture and, you know, this boundaryless creativity. We're always talking about creativity these days and innovation and how do we get our students to really be the thinkers of tomorrow. And I think George and Ira are great examples of that kind of energy and that kind of creativity and that just chutzpah to make things happen. So I think they're going to be great role models for our students.
Mark Clegg, he's Associate Professor of Musicology at the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and the Editor-in-Chief of the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition. Thanks for coming in to talk with us, Mark.
Oh, such a thrill.
Always want to hear from you. Tell us, what stories are you focusing on these days? What issues do you want to hear more about or people that we should profile? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, you can always find us at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Thank you. ahead. My, how times have changed. There is now a big need for construction workers, especially in West Michigan. We find out what's behind the shortage and what it means for the industry. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit Tigers manager Jim Leland has brought his team to the American League Championship Series for the last 3 years. But Saturday night's gut-wrenching elimination in Boston was the final out for Jim Leland. Today, he announced he's retiring. John Keating covers the Tigers for Fox Sports Detroit, and he was at Leland's press conference today. John, what did Jim Leland say? What's behind this decision?
Well, he decided he's low on fuel, and he made that decision in September. September 7th was the day that he pointed to. The Tigers had won a big game the night before. They had handled the Kansas City Royals in Kansas City with ease, and he asked Dave Dombrowski to meet him for coffee, and on that day just informed Dombrowski that he was going to be done at the end of the season. I had occasion after the press conference to interview Dave Dombrowski about that, and Dombrowski said he was surprised but didn't try to talk him out of it, because once Leland makes up his mind on something, it's made up. And so they went from that point forward, September 7th on, as they were trying to win the division and then trying to win a world championship, mm-hmm. with only a few people knowing that, and Mike Ilitch was one that Dave Dombrowski told, and he just didn't want people to realize that he was in the market, or going to be in the market, for a new manager. And so it was a very closely guarded secret until Jim announced it to the team in the Fenway Park clubhouse right after a very tough Game 6, a game that ended their season.
That timing is something. It's a little reminiscent, but not quite as happily, of when Scotty Bowman got another Stanley Cup and then said, okay, I'm retiring. Sadly, Jim Leland can't say he's got that World Series even berth, and that's got to be painful.
But you know, Cindy, that was the ultimate wish for Leland, to get his team, and he thought that his team would be playing for a World Championship, and having made the decision, it would have been absolutely spectacular for him to go out on top and win a second World Championship. He won one with the Marlins way back in 1997, but he thought this team had a chance to do it. And so he's been sort of dealing with this. You know, they had a Game 5 against Oakland, the deciding fifth game in the ALDS, and he knew on that day that it could be his last day as a manager, and he got through that and got on to the next round against the Boston Red Sox, and ultimately had to deal with the disappointment of coming up short. I happened to be outside the Fenway clubhouse and waiting to go in for interviews after the Tigers lost Game 6, and some of the players' kids and a few ancillary members of the staff who were sort of escorted out of the clubhouse. And I had sort of a suspicion that something might be up then, but I really thought today was going to be an announcement that he was coming back on another one-year contract. And so lots of us were pretty surprised by this.
John, the internet and social media, as you well know, was just flaming Saturday night with the finger pointing and criticizing after that loss. A lot of it aimed at Prince Fielder, but a lot aimed at Jim Leland. There was complaints that he overmanaged the Tigers right out of the World Series, like when he pulled Scherzer in Game 2, that seventh inning, and blowing that 5-1 lead. Is that at all fair, that criticism?
Well, no. I mean, you know, the internet is great for lots of things.
Yeah.
But for baseball fans, it's good to vent, but man, is it venomous. And people who really don't know what's going on have opinions that might be best kept to themselves sometimes. You're not aware of whether a guy is hurt or whether a guy is dealing with a particular issue. You know, and Jim Leland is, you know, he's got 50 years in baseball behind him now. He made light of it that right after the press conference today, he was going to join the Skippers Rippers fan club so he can take shots at whoever the next manager of the Tigers will be. We know him to be a very emotional guy, Cindy, and we've seen him, you know, cry in post-game celebrations, things like that. He says that, you know, he doesn't hear any of the speculation or the things that are said about him. Well, I'm here to tell you that he does, and he's human like the rest of us, and, you know, while he comes across as very gruff He's got some thin skin sometimes about the things that he has said. He's not shy in making decisions for his team, doesn't apologize, doesn't backtrack on the decisions that he has made, and leaves himself open to second guessing. And in this world, there's plenty of that, but it's easy for people to say, you should have done this, you should have done that, when you're not right in the minute of a baseball game, managing in the moment as to what might be going on, or knowing what the other manager has on his bench, things like that, that a lot of people don't fully have their arms around.
John Keating, where do you think Jim Leland's era is going to fit into the history of the Tigers?
Well, you know, he touched upon it today that, you know, when he was hired, he replaced a very popular man in Alan Trammell, although Tram didn't have great success as the Tiger manager. And when the Tigers went to the World Series in 2006, he was quick to give credit to Tram for sort of setting up the team that became the American League champs in 2006. He has won 3 straight division titles, and while this team was built for more than that, you know, they were gunning for their 3rd World Series appearance in 8 years. The issue, I think, is there will be lots of people who will be happy that Jim Leland is gone, but those people don't yet have to answer the question, who next?
Any guesses as to who might be the new Tiger skipper? What kind of buzz did you hear?
Zero. Zero. Dave Dombrowski was asked about that. He is completely open to names that are out there. There are a couple of veteran guys on Jim Leland's bench who I'm sure will get some consideration, and Lloyd McClendon and Gene Lamont. I would be surprised if either of those gentlemen were named the next manager of the Tigers. I think he'll probably bring in somebody who's got a little bit more energy, might be a little bit younger. But Dave has had the chance to do some homework on this in September, but was careful to point out that didn't want to let on that he was looking for a new manager, because once word gets out, it spreads in the world of social media like a wildfire. And so, you know, he's sort of poking around a little bit, checking out some names to see who might be available, knowing that come 2014 he was going to be in the market for a new skipper.
John Keating, Fox Sports Detroit, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, John.
My pleasure, Cindy.
In the depths of the Great Recession, here are some words we feared we might never hear again. Help wanted. Construction jobs are going begging. Now, 5 years ago, Michigan's construction industry was pretty much fighting to stay alive, but now it's on the rebound. But home builders say they need more workers, and they're not finding enough folks apparently willing to put in a full day's work on a construction site. In fact, at Grand Rapids Community College, a residential construction training program only drew 5 students. So what's behind this construction labor shortage? We're joined by John Bitely. He's the president and owner of Sable Homes in Grand Rapids. It's good to have you on the program, John.
Thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
And joining John is Donald Grimes, who's a senior research associate with the University of Michigan. He specializes in economic forecasting and regional economic development in our state. Hello, Donald.
Hello.
Good to have you both with us. John, I want to start with what you're finding day in and day out as you try to find workers to build homes. Is it hard for you to find enough workers?
In certain categories, we're very, very short. I'll use carpenters as the lead-in one. We haven't trained anybody in basically 6 years, and it's a trade that traditionally at mid to upper 40s or low 50s, most people transition out of the framing carpentry into other portions of the business. So we've got a real hole in tradesmen in that particular area that needs to be filled.
And what kind of salary would we be talking about for these folks?
Most of our homes are set up so as a lead carpenter in a framing crew situation should gross $35 an hour.
Donald, is this story of that John tells us being echoed by builders all around Michigan, or are there some regions having a harder time attracting these workers than others?
Well, I think you would find a more difficult time finding workers probably over on the west side of the state. That part of the state was hit less hard during the Great Recession and preceding that during the whole 2000. So it's more likely that they're running into problems over in the western side of the state than in the southeast Michigan area.
But certainly there's got to be economic impact in a couple of ways. People who could be making $35 an hour aren't taking those jobs.
Yes. there's been, I think, a bit of an overemphasis on sort of four-year college degrees, liberal arts degrees, and sort of an underestimate of the value of these trade jobs. So I think in a broad sense, the push by the construction industry and local community colleges to emphasize, again, these trade school jobs, which can result in very well-paying positions for people. Part of the problem, of course, is that also tends to be a very cyclical industry. So people, I think, maybe permanently have sort of left the construction industry because during the Great Recession, there were so many job losses, 90,000 in Michigan and 2.2 million in the U.S., that essentially people sort of dropped out of that industry completely. I mean, some of the people who were retired, some of them took disability payments, maybe some of them are working off the books, but there seemed to be a huge decline in the number of construction workers, and that didn't ever seem to be replaced, and those people seem to have dropped out of that industry and occupation over the last decade.
John, what are your thoughts on what Donald raised about high schools not really pushing or opening up kids' minds to the option of the building trades as an avenue of training? Do you see that?
Oh, definitely. And with every good program that comes, there's always issues that are part of it. And no student left behind is creating an issue for us because the high schools, for instance, are really forced to try and get each student to qualify for a four-year degree if they want to. But that doesn't allow them time in their school day to take a trade center type program. The second part of that is unfortunately, I think the trades has been belittled in our nation as a job that you take if you can't get something else or whatever. And that's really sad because there's huge amount of opportunities. And as a self-made individual and cut my teeth and work my way up through, there's plenty of opportunity. And I think as a society, we kind of just shun that.
I am speaking with John Bitely, that's who was speaking, president of Sable Homes in Grand Rapids, and he's joined by Donald Grimes, who's a senior research associate with the University of Michigan, as we look at the fact that home builders, especially in West Michigan, are struggling with a labor shortage, just not enough young people to get in there and work those long days and build a career in the building trades. You know, I remember, and Donald, you did kind of touch on this, when the crash left Michigan's construction industry in such a shambles, didn't we see a lot of workers being forced to head to other states? I remember Wyoming was a big option where, frankly, there was more work than there was in Michigan. So have they not come back home, or are they coming home and working off the books? What do you think?
Well, some of them are working off the books, but in a broad sense, Michigan overall, and not just in the construction trades, is really going to face labor shortages in the future, and it's mostly a demographic issue. Essentially, you're having a lot of people who are now in their 50s or in their 60s, and they're going to retire. And so the labor force overall in the state of Michigan is likely to shrink over the next decade or two. And so a lot of firms, not just in the construction industry, are going to find themselves needing workers who they can't find. It's hard to believe, and I'm sure a lot of people who are listening will wonder if I'm sane or not, but the demographics are going to make employers really crying out for workers going forward in the future, not just in the construction industry, but in a lot of other industries as well. And that's something we're going to be facing 5 years from now or 3 years from now, maybe, much more so than anybody anticipates right now.
So what do you both see as the challenge to, let's start right at the ground level, to parents and to high school counselors and teachers? Let's start with that. What do you both see as the challenge?
If I jump in there, I see the challenge being is number one in our construction world. The future and the opportunities are there, and most of them can be achieved in the trades. And part of the trades is you basically get paid to go to college in the trades. You start out as the basic entry level position, but whether it's 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, and you work at getting your journeyman card, whether it's an electrician, whether it's a plumber, whether it's a a CDL that you drive to the delivery truck at the lumber company, or it's in the cement world where you work in the concrete and learn how to do different things, or carpentry and you graduate from basically carrying lumber to a carpenter to a craftsman that can actually run a crew. We need to get the word out that you don't need to spend 20 or 50 or 40 or whatever $1,000 on a college degree when you can actually come to work and learn your degree and get paid to do so, and end up with an economically viable job that can support yourself and a family if you wish.
And Donald, what's your view as you do the research at the University of Michigan and you look at this forecasting? So you see this big gap. So what's the call to action right now?
Although I hate to undermine my employer, which is a university, but I think generally the statement is correct. There's a bit of an overemphasis on four-year degrees, and there are going to be lots of opportunities for people with less education. You know, whether or not how successful you are in that, even in a trade position or in a sort of a junior management position, is going to depend upon your own endeavors once you start. But there are going to be lots of opportunities, and a lot of that's going to be driven by the demographics where people are getting old and retiring, and so they'll be opening up going forward. And I'm actually pretty confident that people who are not four-year college graduates can have a good career path ahead of them if they're ambitious and self-driven and pursue those opportunities when they're presented. So I guess I would basically agree and hope that we don't become too focused on just four-year colleges.
From where you sit and what you see, Donald Grimes, are there things that the construction industry in Michigan should be doing that perhaps it's not right now to get that word out?
Maybe. And going back to the whole notion of a four-year degree, we're almost set up to bribe people with the way the financial aid packages are set up for kids to go to four-year colleges. And then, of course, they borrow all this money and they end up hugely in debt. And then they can't find a job to repay that, or if they do, they're going to be broke for a long time to come. So I think in some sense, you know, that there needs to be more sort of financial aid or similar financial aid packages available for people in the trade schools as opposed to just for going to the colleges. And that might be one package that you could sort of like offer that financial assistance the same way if you're learning a trade. So I think that's one area where public policy might need to be revisited. A second sort of comes up is this notion, and I've heard anecdotal stories about drug testing. That's much more prevalent today than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And that may be an impediment to hiring some people in some of these positions where people are failing these drug tests. And that is hurting our ability to get workers into these fields who it may or may not be a functional problem for them in terms of the job, but they fail the test. That may be something we need to revisit as well.
Opening our minds to the labor shortage for home builders in Michigan. That was Donald Grimes, who is a senior research associate with the University of Michigan. And he was joined from Grand Rapids by the president and owner of Sable Homes, John Bitely. Thanks so much to both of you for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having us, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.